Good morning.
Good morning.
It is good to get to be together here on this nice, brisk November morning. And with it being November, we are coming on the end of our theme for the whole year. It's been a while since we talked about it, but our theme for the year has been being conquerors, how we can conquer through Christ. And we've looked at that from the book of Revelation through these different letters that Christ wrote to his churches. And at the end of each of his letters, he would say, to the one who conquers. And so this whole year, we've been talking about how our life for Christ is like this spiritual battle. And if we're not fighting that battle, we're not going to win that battle. But it takes energy and focus, and it takes a lot of different things that we've outlined throughout this year. And so this morning, we are going to get into our final focus of that. We are going to be talking about conquering with patience. And this is a nice one to end with, because this is probably the toughest one. Because of all the qualities that we might say we need to work on, I think probably most people say, man, I wish I had some more patience. That's one that I really need. And particularly, we're going to look at conquering with patience when we go through those challenging times that try our patience. Because that's what you see a lot in the book of Revelation, particularly in those letters to the churches, is several of those churches were going through really difficult times that would tend to make you not want to be very patient. And we're going to particularly look at that this morning with the Church of Philadelphia. Sermon this morning, I'm titling, Jesus is Key. Because that's an interesting note there at the beginning of that letter to Philadelphia, is this odd thing he says about how I hold the key of David. The key of David? Like, where does that even come from in the Bible? Well, where did we get this whole idea of a key of David? That's what we're going to explore this morning. But I want to kind of give some background first before we get into that and talk a little bit about suffering. Because it's suffering and pain and challenges and struggles in life. That's kind of what we're going to be talking about for the next several sermons. What is it that makes suffering so difficult? And you might say, well, it's obvious. I mean, it's painful. Nobody likes to be in pain. And suffering is difficult because I don't like to hurt. And yet, I think there's something more to it than that, because many of us will purposely put ourselves into painful situations voluntarily and actually enjoy it. Think about someone who likes to work out a lot, and they purposely do things to their body that actually makes it hurt, but you talk to them and they'll actually tell you they enjoy doing that. And you might think, well, that's weird. They're just strange people. But there is something, for some reason, many of us are willing to go through painful circumstances, and we would not think of it as something, we wouldn't even call that suffering. So what's the difference between purposely putting yourself through something a bit challenging and what we actually think of as trials and suffering? One way we might be able to find a difference would be this, that when we go through suffering, we feel powerless. To me, I think that may be one of the most difficult parts of trials and suffering. That when I go through those painful times, it's not just that it hurts, it's that I can't do anything about it. I'm out of control of that situation. You know, if you go work out, well, that's totally voluntary. You know that you can stop whenever you want to, and you kind of know what you're getting into, and it's totally within your control. But I think when suffering is really difficult is when you feel like you don't have that control anymore. And sometimes I think we have hope in suffering when we still hold on to that control. If I'm going through a hard time, but I'm pretty sure that I've got a doctor's appointment this week, and the doctor's going to get me the medication that's going to help me get better, and I'm not going to be sick anymore, then I think, well, I'm not that discouraged. It's kind of an annoying thing. It's a nuisance, but I've got some hope going on. But if you're in a situation where it doesn't seem like there's a lot of hope, where, I mean, the list of those kinds of circumstances go on and on. I passed out all the resumes, and I don't have a job. Still don't have a job, it's been several months. Don't feel like I have any control over the situation anymore. that's when we start thinking, Bill, this is a suffering kind of situation. This is a trial that I'm going through. Or a situation where you're in some kind of relationship and it's a difficult relationship and you've done everything you can to change the circumstances and it's not going to change. At that point, it feels like it's out of your control. Or a health challenge. A lot of times we go through health challenges where did everything I can. I don't think this is, I'm just going to have to live with this one. Or the list goes on and on of the kinds of suffering and challenges we go through where what makes it so much worse is I feel powerless in this situation. And we can think of that in our own lives, but biblical examples are really helpful in this. And the one I wanted to start by focusing on is the story of Joseph. Here's the way I picture suffering. This is kind of like if we're in a room. You're standing in a room. As long as I can go in and out of that room, I'm okay with that. It may not be the most pleasant room. As long as I can walk out of the room whenever I want, I'm good. Where suffering really gets in is when the door closes and I can't seem to budge it and get it open. That's when we start to lose hope and say, I'm really going through a hard trial right now. And that's what I think you see in Joseph's life. When we think about Joseph's life, it started out really good and everything. He's got freedom in that he's not captive in any way. He has a father who loves him. He has a challenging situation with his brothers, but at least his father seems to love him. And so you can say there's a lot of good things in his life towards the beginning. But then, as you know with the story, what happens is his brothers get jealous of him and they throw him in a pit. And the next thing you know, he's in a situation like this. Think about when Joseph was sitting in that pit. I mean, it was very literally a room that he could not escape. That here he is in a situation where, regardless of what he did, he couldn't change the circumstances. And in fact, it's interesting, later on in that story, one of the brothers mentions that Joseph pleaded with them when he was in that pit. So you just kind of put that extra detail in the story. You think of Joseph at the bottom of this pit pleading with them, guys, please don't hurt me, don't harm me. And instead of listening to that, they sell him off into slavery. And again, it's kind of this closed door circumstance where he's stuck in this situation he can't get out of. You think of slavery, I mean, that's the whole idea of slavery. It's totally voluntary. Well, it's not exactly slavery anymore. But slavery is the kind of idea where they're trapped, that you have some sort of as a prisoner, and they're going to be your possession. And he's stuck in that for some probably lengthy period of time, and that seems to be a very challenging situation. Goes through some major temptations during that period, until things get even worse when he tries to do the right thing, and he's falsely accused, and the next thing you know, he's in prison. And then you have very literally this kind of closed door situation where he can't get out. And it seems like that went on for quite a period of time. And then there's this hopeful situation where he interprets this guy's dream and he says, hey, when you get out of prison, make sure you remember me, talk to Pharaoh, since you've got some connections to Pharaoh, make sure you get me out. And the guy, no sooner does he get out of prison, but he forgets Joseph, and Joseph's still stuck. And this is where I think we would say he's powerless. He's done everything he can to change his circumstances, and he can't change them. And to me, that would be the definition of a trial, a suffering type situation. So, when we're going through these kinds of situations, what does that lead us to do? The moment you figure out that you're in a situation where the door is locked and you're stuck, where does that generally lead you? I think the most natural directions that we might go with that is, I feel depressed when I'm in a situation that I don't know when that situation's ever going to change, may never change. That leads to depression. It also leads people to losing their faith sometimes. That, why doesn't God do something about it? I don't know. Maybe there isn't a God. And a whole variety of other things. It leads people to be very angry, very resentful. It leads them to treat other people around them in ways that they shouldn't treat them. I mean, just a lot of things because we feel trapped. And that seems like a natural kind of way to deal with these kinds of circumstances. But, of course, that's not how God wants us to deal with it. So, after looking at it from this human perspective, now let's go to God's Word and see how does God want us to deal with these kinds of circumstances. Turn over to Revelation, Revelation chapter 3, and we are going to be in that section that Glenn just read for us, talking about Christ's letter to the church there in Philadelphia. I'm not going to go read the whole thing since Glenn just read it for us. Instead, I'm going to be picking out different verses and trying to understand their circumstances and compare it to what we know here. One thing that jumped out to me when we read that is in verse 8, Revelation chapter 3, verse 8. Jesus says, "I know that you have but little power." That's very similar to what we just talked about. Here's the Philadelphia church, and he says, you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of power. You're kind of restricted right now. And it wasn't that it was an illusion that they felt like they didn't have a lot of power, but actually they had a lot of power. Now he says, I saw you, you don't have a lot of power. Exactly like what we've been talking about. And then further, we're kind of trying to figure out, well, what is it that they were powerless in? What was the situation they were struggling with? And with each of these letters in Revelation, it's kind of hard to figure it out. What exactly are they going through? In this one, the clue we have is in verse 9. It says, "Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie." And then he goes on. But you have this interesting little detail about these Jews who are not really Jews. They're not really serving God like they should. In fact, he says they're serving Satan. And the fact that he would bring up these Jews to these Christians means that there's got to be some kind of relationship going on here. Perhaps, and to me this seems like the most likely thing, is that there's some kind of persecution going on. That maybe these Jews who are actually worshiping Satan are making things really hard on the Christians. And we see that throughout the book of Acts, we see that happening quite a bit. And so possibly that's what's happening here in Philadelphia. Whatever it was, it sounds like they're going through some kind of trial. You just read through that letter, and I don't think you can escape that. It really seems like there's some kind of a challenge that they're going through, and they feel powerless in that circumstance. Okay, so as Christ is writing this letter to them, let's think about, he's writing to this, let's pretend we're the church in Philadelphia. We're these Christians who are going through a hard time, we feel powerless, we're stuck in this circumstance, and then Christ writes to us, and here's what he says. Let's go back to the beginning of the letter. Verse 7, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens." So in the midst of this trial that seems like nothing can change it, here comes Jesus, and he says, "I'm holy, I'm true, and I'm holding here this key." And he describes it here as the key of David. Now that is a quotation back from the book of Isaiah. In the book of Isaiah, it references this concept of the key of David and someone having it. And in that passage, it basically was just the authority of the throne. That this person kind of has the authority that would go along with having that throne. Okay, so that's kind of the background of this phrase. Can you apply it to Christ? What does that mean about Christ? Christ has the authority of the throne of David. That he's the Messiah. That he sits on that throne. And it's not just a title, but he carries all of the power of what that would mean to be the Christ, to be the prophesied one, to be the one who is sitting on that throne as the Son of God. He holds all the power of that position. So what's the power? He says, well, with this key, I can open doors. And when I open a door, I'm so powerful that once that door is open, nobody can close it. And there's no human being who's strong enough to close that door. And furthermore, he says, with this key, I can close a door. And I'm so powerful in closing that door that there's no human being who can open that door. That's the power of this key that Jesus says that he holds. Okay, so what does that mean for their situation? Here's what he says. Verse 8, "I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut." Here's what he's picturing. Here they are in their situation in Philadelphia. It looks hopeless. They're stuck. They're trapped. They're powerless. And Jesus says, I've got good news for you. I found the key. And the door's about to open. So, what does that mean? What is this open door all about? What is he describing here? It seems like it's some kind of a change in their circumstances. As we're going to see, he's going to describe several major changes that are going to happen in their circumstances. But also in the background, this whole idea of Christ opening doors and closing doors, there is some New Testament background to that. In the New Testament, particularly Paul, will use this metaphor of doors opening and closing. Turn with me over to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Here's how Paul uses this metaphor of swinging open a door and closing a door. 1 Corinthians 16, this is the end of 1 Corinthians, and Paul's kind of just wrapping up some personal stuff. And here's what he says in verse 5. I will visit you after passing through Macedonia, for I intend to pass through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter, so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. For I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you, if the Lord permits. But I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. Okay, so Paul is saying, I'm planning to come visit you guys over there in Macedonia. That's my plan, is I'm going to go spend some time with you. But then he does give this kind of thing that, if God wills. So he's saying, you know, if God's willing for that to happen, then that's my plan. But then he says, but right now, I really want to stay in Ephesus. And the reason is because this door has opened for me to, as he says it, a wide door for effective work has opened to me. Here's the metaphor of the door here is some kind of work that he can do. And we know Paul, that work would be gospel preaching. Some kind of effective work has opened up where he can be more effective in spreading the gospel. And he's saying, so that's where I need to be right now because this is the door that God's opened right now. Okay, several things we see here is that Paul's basing his plans on what he sees God doing. That, hey, God has opened up a door for me. I need to be going through that door right now. Then he's saying, and I plan to later on, my plan, just human plan, is I'm going to go over and visit you all. Now, that's contingent on if God wants that to happen. So Paul's sort of thinking in terms of God opening and closing different doors. Now, look with me in another passage where Paul does this again. Colossians chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4, Paul actually prays for a door like this. Colossians 4 verse 2. Continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us, that God may open to us a door for the word, to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear which is how I ought to speak. So here he's saying, pray for us, particularly pray that God will open a door for the gospel. Same thing that he said happened earlier there in Ephesus. He's saying, pray that that will happen here. That God will open a door so that we can speak the gospel. And that I'll know what to speak and all that. So here we see again, this door seems to be this opportunity kind of thing. That seems to be what the metaphor symbolizes. And it's the kind of thing that Paul feels like he can ask God to do. It's something God does, but it's something he can ask God to please do for him. Okay, so the question is that the kind of door that we're talking about in Revelation? And I think that it is. Let's go back to Revelation. Revelation chapter 3 again. Look in verse 8. Here's where we get back to the talking about the Jews there. Verse 8. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that you are Jews, say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. So in this open door metaphor, he then turns and says, those Jews who say that they're Jews and they're not really, he says, I'm going to change that circumstance. I'm going to change it to where they come to you, and they bow down before you, and they recognize that I've loved you. So this is a total change of their circumstances, and it really parallels what Paul was saying with this whole idea of opening up a door for the gospel. That here's these people who are serving Satan, and now they come and they recognize Christ's love for his people, and it sounds like turning to Christ is really what it seems to describe here. Okay, so putting that all together, what you get is here's a church that's going through a really difficult time, and Christ says, don't worry about it, I've got good news for you. I've got this key. With this key, I can open a door, and your circumstances are going to be totally changed. A whole new opportunity is suddenly going to be open for you all. Let's think about this from that sort of standpoint. If we can think about life in this different kind of way, that instead of be thinking of, I'm trapped in this circumstance, and just the way it worked out, if we can think of it in terms of something more like this opportunity, that Christ opens his door and here's this new opportunity. If we can think of it in a bigger scale of life like this, Christ opening and closing doors, that life is a bit more like, instead of feeling just like, well, you're trapped in this situation, it's more like at certain times Christ decides to open certain things and Christ decides to close certain things. And it's like, I just picture it like it's wandering from room to room of these different circumstances throughout our life as Christ chooses to open this and close that. When you start thinking about life that way, it changes certain things. And here's what it changes. If we can start picturing our circumstances in this way, here's some things that I think it teaches us. One, circumstances are not forever. When Joseph was going through that difficult time, and he was sitting in that prison cell, if I were Joseph, I would think, this is how it's going to be. It's been this way for years. It hasn't gotten any better. It has gotten worse. I don't see things changing. This is just forever. Jesus shows to these Philadelphia Christians, it's not forever. I've got the key. I can change the circumstances. That should give some hope. Next concept here. We need to be looking for those open doors. That here, Jesus said, I have set before you this open door. He didn't say, I'm about to thrust you through a door. He said, I just put this in front of you. Here's a door that's open. It seems very similar to how Paul viewed it. How I've noticed that there's this open door here for the gospel in Ephesus, therefore I think I'll stick around here and do a lot of preaching. It's this kind of concept that when Christ opens that door, we need to be looking for it and ready to utilize that. Next point. This is more complicated. One room may be necessary for the next room. This is really interesting to think through it the way that worked with the Philadelphia Christians. If they were going through this challenge with these Jews who said they were worshiping Satan, Jesus then eventually turns around and says, now they're going to come and they're going to fall down before you. I'm a whole new situation, new room. And they're going to recognize that I've loved you. Recognize, like, past tense that he loved them in the past. Like, recognize seeing what Christ did for them in the past. And it seems like somehow their circumstances in the past are going to influence these people in the future. You particularly see that even more so in the life of Joseph. You think about the way God guided him from room to room in his life. And at the end, as he's finally exalted to second in command of Egypt, and he sees where God brought him, he could have looked back and seen, all right, there's a reason. Look, I was in this room, and this room, and this room. It didn't make any sense at the time, but those rooms were necessary to get me to this destination that God had for me in mind. And he actually says exactly that at the end of the book of Genesis, in Genesis 50, verse 19, the famous words of Jesus, I think, or famous words of Joseph. I think this is what the kids have been memorizing in their classes right now. Genesis 50, verse 19, but Joseph said to them, do not fear, for I am in the place of God. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. This concept that you may look at those circumstances and you may see that they were very negative. God meant it for good to bring about all that he brought about here. And in fact, there's this, to me, it's a really almost eerie similarity between the church in Philadelphia and the story of Joseph. That here in the story of Joseph, He goes through this hard, powerless time. And then at the end, his brothers, who were his former enemies, come down and literally bow down before him and literally recognize that God had loved this, loved him. And so you have this really interesting similarity there. And the end result is Joseph can look back on his life and he's like, yeah, it makes so much sense now. I went through all that so I could get to here. And if you see it in Joseph's life, and you see it in the Philadelphia Christians, it would make sense that Christ would continue to do that with us today as well. Okay, one last one on this. Here's the fourth point. And this one's a little complicated too. How we live may determine which door Jesus chooses to open. Here's what I mean by that with the Philadelphia Christians. Look with me in verse 10. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. So here's Jesus with like his master map here, planning out, here's where I'm going to open for them and close for them. And he's saying, I've decided for you Christians there in Philadelphia, I'm not going to let you go in this trial time. The whole rest of the world is going to be going through a major period of trial. But you guys in particular are not going to have to go through that trial. Well, why not? I mean, do you just kind of play favorites and that's just how you do it? He said, well, actually, he says, because. He gives us because statement. Because you kept my word about patient endurance. So because of the way you acted in this room, therefore I've decided to open a different door so that you don't go into this other room. Now, I don't know what all the background of that is. Like, why was it that just because they were patient during this trial, they didn't need to go through another trial? I mean, I wish there was so much more information on like how Jesus made that decision and what the reasoning was behind it. But what it does show is that how we choose to deal with these circumstances may determine what kinds of circumstances Christ puts in front of us in the future, which is really interesting to think about. Okay, let's wrap this up here. What should this lead us to do? If we start seeing life in this kind of way, how should that change the way we live? Well, before we notice that if we feel like we're stuck in this circumstance, the thing that's going to make us do is feel depressed and discouraged and all of that. Instead, if we see it as Christ holds the key, and at his time he decides to open, he decides to close, he has the power over those circumstances, here's what it could do. And here's what it did for the Philadelphia Christians. Verse 8. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. First thing they did is they kept Christ's word. If Christ is the one who has the key, if he's the one who has the power over this situation, then the most logical thing to do is to follow his commands, follow his orders, stay faithful to him. So that's the first thing, which really, this is, what's interesting to me is that's a very active thing. We could look at this and say, well, if it's just a bunch of Christ opening and closing doors, it's a totally passive thing. I'm kind of just like riding a little fair ride that takes me through this thing. No, that's not the way at all. Instead, he's saying, what we need to be doing is being faithful to Christ. If he's the one who's that much in control of the situation, then the thing I need to do is be faithful to him. But secondly, and here's the harder one, look what they say. In verse 10. Because you have kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial. Second thing that those Philadelphia Christians did is they were patient. And the reason they could be patient is if we see this situation as Christ is the one in control. And if he has the power to open the door, he has the power to shut the door, my role is to be patient and to wait on Christ. Now, if I don't see Christ having the key, if I don't see anyone having power over my circumstances, then there's no hope, and it's very difficult to be patient when there's nothing to be hopeful for. But if I can see that Christ is the one in control and that there is that hope, there is the fact that he, at his time, can change the situation, then I have something to be patient and to patiently wait for. And that's what those Christians to do. Now, let's wrap this up. This key that Christ has, what is this key? What is this literal key that he's holding here? It's interesting that throughout these letters to the churches, that all of the imagery actually is drawn from Revelation chapter 1. That when John first sees Christ and he falls down at his feet, he describes him with all these things, his eyes like fire, his hands doing these things, all these different things that it describes. And all those things are then taken and applied to these letters. And the key is also found in chapter 1. So look with me back in chapter 1. And what's interesting is the key is found in chapter 1, but it's described very differently. Chapter 1, verse 17. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Fear not. I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades." Here he's described as holding keys, but it doesn't say the key of David. Instead, it says the key of death and Hades. And then he ties that back to saying how I was dead and I've come back to life. So, what's this key he's holding here? What this seems to show is this key that he has, it's not just to open some earthly opportunity. If that's what it was, that's nice, and we talked the whole lesson about it, and that gives us hope, and that's nice to see that he can change our earthly circumstances with the turn of a key. But it really sounds like from Revelation that this key is for a whole lot more than just changing opening some little door here on earth. Instead, it sounds like this key is for opening the room that is the most tightly shut of all rooms. If you think of any situation that we as humans are the most powerless in, it would be the grave, where I literally can do nothing, and where it literally seems eternal and permanent. That of all the trials and traps and permanent situations, that would be it. And Christ says, that is the one I have the power of. I can open that door. And what I can lead you to is to a new situation. And look at how this new situation is described at the end of that letter to the Philadelphia Christians. Back to chapter 3, verse 11. Let's close with this. Verse 11, here's how he describes the new situation that he's going to lead them to after, as he says, they conquer. Verse 11, "I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." He leads them into this new place. It's God's temple. It's a new room. And it's a room that there's never a door that opens and they accidentally walk out of. He says you're going to stay there permanently. And the way he describes that is as a pillar. You're a pillar. You don't take a pillar out of a building. It causes a lot of damage when you do that. If you become a pillar in that building, that's your permanent place. And so here's what Christ has done. He's taken them from a circumstance that seems like it's going to last forever. And he's like, that's not going to last forever. I've got the key. All I do is open the door and you walk out. That one's easy. And he takes them into a situation that he says, this one's forever. That's the one that really lasts. And so really where our hope lies is not so much in, well, maybe next week Christ is going to turn the key and my circumstance is going to change and I'm going to be happy instead of sad. Maybe he will, and certainly he does that a lot. But really where our hope lies is that all of these circumstances here on earth are so small and limited. And that ultimately he's leading us to a room that we can stay in forever that's perfect, where all of those trials are gone. That's what we're looking forward to. And the reason we have that hope is because he's the one who died and was resurrected. And that's why he has the key to death and Hades. Let's be faithful to Christ. Let's live a life of patience, recognizing that he is the one who has the power. If you're not following Christ this morning, then we invite you to come and fall down at Christ's feet and give him your allegiance. Recognize that he's the one who's powerful and realize that your life belongs entirely to him. Please come and give your life to him this morning while together we stand and we sing.